Well, it's probably all condensed. What is this? All condensed gas, right? Okay, so this, I'll be speaking about some joint results with Martti Lassos and Takao Yamaguchi. Now, that will be about stability of inverse problems within the boundary control method that Martti was explaining. Now, let us consider the case when you have just Laplace operator, and let us assume that although boundary control method assumes that there is a boundary, there is no boundary. So it will be inverse problem with local data. Roughly speaking, the situation is like the following. Martti was speaking about the case when there was a boundary and there was a data on the boundary. Now assume that you have, like, a, for example, a ball or any other open set, say this room, and this room you make the measurements. So in Martti's version, it will be the following. You look for the, so this room is a part of some unknown manifold. And that's where you make measurements. In omega. Now, if we go back to what Martti was telling about the formulation problem with the following, you're looking for the wave equation. And u for t less than 0 is 0. So there is no boundary. In my talk, dm is empty set. And then you have a solution. And since you're sitting on this room and listening to me, and hopefully nothing goes from outside, the data will be polling. You have the support of H lies in omega cross R plus. Okay, and what you measure is u inside, so you know the solution u inside. So from h, you go to uh back on omega, say for example 0 t capital, to be very, very much like Martti was talking about. Now, then it turns out that more or less everything Martti was telling about may be done for this case. So for the case when you have measurements not on the boundary, but inside some fixed domain of your unknown manifold. So you'll get from here, when t is large enough, and t should be, as you remember, more than 2 diameter of, well, it's actually not necessary, maybe some, but if it is more than 2 diameters of m, then it's, if you know this map, that is, will be denoted Martti by lambda or by g? Lambda. Lambda t from h to this one. So you know, if you know lambda t, for t more than 2 diameters, then they determine you uniquely manifold and its metric. Uniquely means, of course, up to class of isometries. I'll be speaking slightly about different formulation of the problem. Yes? Sorry? No, it's operator. You know operator.
What is the dependence on omega? Which omega are we talking? You thought you were going to
vary omega. Omega is fixed. That's this room. And you want to look for the universe. You're sitting in this room and you're looking for the universe.
So omega is the data also.
Omega is the data, right. Omega is given, right. So you're given omega and I'll put it with G, though it is not necessary, as Martti explained. So you're sitting at the omega, given omega, no, say, metric here, and you produce noise, like I produce, right? And there is a sound, and we measure sound inside. It's an open, non-empty set.
Well, a tiny neighborhood of a point is okay.
Yes, yes. Stability will be worse, of course, but yes. Yes. Ah, and of course, you should understand that M should be connected. Otherwise, what you do here will not affect any other. So M will be, this means that it's compact, connected, manifold, without boundary. Now, originally, I assumed that it is smooth, like Matti assumed. Now, let me go to slightly different version of data that is sort of equivalent to this one. In some sense, it's easier to measure, or you know, or more related to the original Gilfand problem. Now, let us go back to the underlying Laplace operator. So, look for the Laplacian delta G. No boundary condition, since no boundary, and look for its spectral data. Spectral, so that gives you the spectrum. Counting multiplicity and eigenfunctions, phi zero, that is constant. I'll tell you why it is one, phi one, and so on. So why I put phi equal to one? Strictly speaking, you say that phi is one over square root of volume, but I use probabilistic measure. So I assume that this is Laplacian, and instead of usual Riemannian measure, I take just probabilistic measure. D mu h. H is, for some historical reason, measure. It will be h in my talk. Because g will be some group if I count the groups. So this will be delta h. Sorry. So it's probabilistic measure. It's just usual Riemannian volume divided by the volume of the whole manifold. It's bounded, it's manifold, it's compact. Then the corresponding normalization will be phi zero is one. So then the formulation that is equivalent, which is by the way not trivial to show that it's equivalent, is the following one. What you know your omega, you know all eigenfunctions called eigenpairs, and eigenvalues and eigenfunctions sitting on omega. Okay. So it's of course easy to construct from here the Green's kernel for the wave equation. It's slightly more difficult to explain that if you know Green's kernel for the wave equation for this time, that give you this data. Now, moreover, when I was somehow giving talks like that, people often say, well, how on earth can you measure eigenfunctions sitting on this room that are normalized? And it's probably a good question. So equivalent data will be the following, that what you know is the heat kernel corresponding to the heat operator. So you're looking for the heat operator. Or give you one more H. Oh, my God.
Script H.
Script H, right. So right. So you look for the heat kernel. And heat kernel, of course, is related to lambda k phi k through simple formula h of x y t is sum e to the power minus lambda k t phi k of x phi k of y. And then you see, of course, that knowledge of lambda k phi k and knowledge of h restricted to this domain are equivalent. So you can say equivalent formulation of the problem will be that we maybe go here. And that's the one that will appear in formulation of the problem. So now let me formulate the problem. You have omega and you have heat kernel x, y, t, and x and y runs in omega and t is positive. So that's all equivalent problems, and you obviously say that now you can measure heat kernel. Just take a matches, produce the sort of delta source, and measure the temperature. Then, basically, what Matti said implies a result is that from this data, we can uniquely define M and H. Probably yes. Well, if you know everything, you know everything. But if you know with some error, well, assume that you know heat kernel only some during some finite time and with some error. That means that you know only the lower energy eigenvalues of the eigenfunctions and corresponding lambda k. Okay, with some error. So I don't think that accurate things were done. Somehow, how to go, what corresponds to what, in which norm. Now, let us assume, as because of stability, the situation is the following. Assume that really we don't know heat kernel precisely. Moreover, we don't even know omega precisely. What we know is heat kernel restricted to some points, discrete set of points in omega. So assume we know so this H of X, Y, T, I put it H of P, Q, and say L, because you have just some finite number of points. So what is this? This is just H of some points X, P, Y, Q, and T, L. That is presumably what we can really measure. And with some error. With some error. And the question is, what can we say about M and H, if we can say anything? And the answer is, we can say nothing without any a priori data, because it's our inverse problems are ill-posed. So, for example, one of the examples that I like is the following. Well, we're sitting on this. You give me epsilon and say, well, I can recover manifold with this epsilon. And I say, okay, and now I add somewhere here some tiny handle. Handle, so remember that H corresponds to the Brownian motion. And actually what we measure is the probability of Brownian motion to go from HP to YQ in the time TL. And the probability that it is this small tiny handle for it to get into here is zero. Well, not zero, it's small, it's going to this error. And say, well, I increase my error, mean decrease. And say, okay, and now let me put 10 handles, but very, very small. So therefore, the issue is, so we need to do something to get stability. And the general thing how to get stability, again, what Marty talked on one of his lectures, is the following. Assume we have two spaces, two topological Hausdorff spaces, X and Y, and X is compact, and there is a map D from the word direct to some Hausdorff space Y, and this is our model. This are well, in this case, this our manifolds that have they don't have omega. They have some points, some finite number of points. Well, usually we'll take YP is equal to XP. That's not completely necessary, but let's for simplicity do like that. So Y will be the measurements of the heat kernel. And the question is, well, you measure heat kernels, is inverse map is stable, is continuous. So what about D minus 1? And as Marty told, and sort of, I think, the first half-year topology, since X is compact, to get this, the simplest way is to prove that D is injective plus continuous from the topology of X and topology of Y. Injectivity is, you know, it's the uniqueness of our inverse problem. So that's what we're doing very, very often. So it seems that what Marty said is fine. You know, because they have injectivity. No, it actually will be enough by sort of compactness arguments to prove that you can measure x, y, t for x and y, y in omega, or in dense set of points in omega. And then by some some continuity to have finite number of points. So injectivity is really, it's the uniqueness of inverse problem that Marty was discussed. Stability or continuity will be that if you somehow change properly this x, go to the nearest point, close point in x, then our measurements in these points, to have injectivity, of course, you have infinitely many points, will change little. Correct? So that's what is the standard topological background. There are several questions that I want to explain before I go to formulational theorem. Then I come to formulational theorem, and then I would say that my task was carried out, and then I'll become very sort of lazy and giving here and there. There are several questions. What is the topology on X, on this our manifolds? How, sorry? In principle, I want to look at all manifolds. Right. What is the topology of X? How to make X compact? And whether the direct map is continuous. And again, you would say that, well, of course, direct map is continuous if you proper find topology. But topology on X is not really trivial because you don't even know. Once again, let's be a bit more careful. What do we really measure? We really measure the following story. We have a dense set of points, so let X be, let X be dense, and let's for, to make it precise, in some ball of radius R centered at some point P lying in manifold MH. Okay? And let's TL, remember that YP is just the same as XP. And let TL will be dense in zero infinity. So you get a sort of unrelated set of points. You don't really measure, have the distance between them. And what you know is the following map. So you have the map from M and the ball that lies in M, H, into this H, P, Q, L. That is, oops, sorry, subscript H. H beautiful of X, P, Y, Q, T, L. So that is sort of the full data. And then it turns out, just somehow because they're dense, you can really find, well, we don't know omega. So probably I'll come to that later. It turns out that from this data you can find, slightly modifying what Marty was saying, the manifold and the metric. In particular, you find this ball, how it looks like and where these points are lying in this ball. Right, and what's the point P, and so on and so forth. So that's our direct problem. You have a manifold, and you have a manifold with distinguished point P. So that's what, so it is a pointed manifold. And say you have R that defines your ball. I put also R more than zero. And from this data, there's a heat kernel on the dense set of the point and dense set on the time to recover the manifold. And Marty somehow with sort of, I probably did a touch, but more or less what Marty told during the first lectures is how to solve this problem, how from these data to recover M and H. And now there is a natural problem, as I described. Assume you don't have all these points and don't have all the time. After all, you want to go for coffee at 3:30. Actually, 3 even. So we have even less points and times. So what can you say about M and H? And then, as I showed to you, we should be very, very careful because we probably can say something very little. And that comes to the question on what is the topology of the set of manifolds and what will be the compacts on the set of manifolds. Now, the topology of the sets of manifolds in general, say, compact metric spaces, is quite natural to take more or less, in the beginning, the weakest topology, that is Gromov topology. So, I like the following definition of Gromov topology. There are quite many of them, and the one that we'll be using is the following. Assume you have two metric spaces, that M is manifold
X and Y.
That was X, I put it like this X and this Y. These are compact metric spaces. Okay, so then we say that the epsilon Gromov close, or the distance, Gromov distance between these two guys, Gromov-Hausdorff in between X and Y, is less than epsilon if there are measurable maps. Well, we don't. Oh, sorry, there is no measurable. Just if there are maps, measurable will appear later. F from X to Y and F prime from Y to X that almost don't change the distance. So this tells us how they can change the distance. So if I have dy of f of x prime and compare with dx of x and x prime, and I do the same with f prime, so this will be less than epsilon. And I do the same with f prime, so it will be, let me write probably, dy f prime of, sorry, dx f prime of y, f prime of y prime, and I compare with the original distance in y between y and y prime, it is less than epsilon. And we can assume, though it doesn't go to the original Gromov definition, that this f and f prime are almost inverse to each other. So that means that if I take, for example, dx of f prime f of x, and compare with x, it will be less than epsilon. So the distortion of the metric, roughly speaking, is small. Then you say that these two metric spaces are epsilon Gromov-Hausdorff close. So it turns out that then you can speak about the compacts with respect to this metric. How to define a compact in the space of the manifolds, or better say, metric spaces, with this Gromov-Hausdorff metric that turn out to be compact. And there are sort of industry in related to finding compacts and behavior in these compacts. We in this, yes? Ah, yes, I need this one, right. Thank you. In this our paper, we considered the very first and classical compact that is introduced by Gromov. It is the case when sectional curvature is bounded and diameter is bounded. So let us call it M, script M, of lambda and B, and put N. N is the limit for dimension, but I can just take, we have manifolds of dimension M. So these are all manifolds. P means they're pointed. So I have the singular point that is the center of the universe, that's of course where I am now at the moment. such that the sectional curvature R of M, R stands for sectional curvature, is less than lambda, and diameter of M is less than D, and also assume that dimension of M is, strictly speaking, less or equal than N. Okay. So that's a class of manifolds that we consider. And to be honest, okay, I think we take just dimension M equal to N. Not take it, say, for simplicity. Not necessarily. By the way, if you look at the cloud of points, you mean the dense points in BR, you have no idea what is dimension. You know, still there are infinitely many of them, that's all. Right? So it turns out at some moment from what Marty told you can extract, and probably I'll tell a little bit. Now, so you look at this set of manifolds, M script capital, and it turns out it's almost a compact. It's actually a pre-competent Gromov-Hausdorff topology. So, and we need compact to have inverse boundaries, right? So we need to close it. So let us look for the closure. Go for M P closure of lambda DPN. This is the closure of M P in Gromov-Hausdorff distance. And that ends the first drop. The point is that, as we see it very soon, this when you come to the closure and you look for the, well, even for the direct problem probably, even more for the inverse problem, you need to define heat operator, and you need to check that the inverse problem is injective. So what Marty did was for C-infinity case, and this is not C-infinity case. So what can happen? What are nasty things that can happen? Actually, there is a paper, I think it's 95, of Fukaya, Gromov, and Chigger, that describe the structure of this set. And structure is pretty complicated. It's a sort of stratified manifolds, meaning that so first of all, that will be a when you come to here, that will be a metric space, and this metric space is actually, you can imagine it's something with edge, wedges, conic points, and things like that. So roughly speaking, you can, if say M, it's still not completely bad structure. It's something that we'll see soon is almost everywhere manifold. So if M now lies in here, you can stratify it in, so this is S0, and that is S1, and say it can lose dimension, by the way. So dimension of M may not be N. Dimension of N will be some K that may be less than N. So the last one is SK, and somehow dimension, this is the smallest dimension, actually it's not good to write, probably it's better to write this way. Yeah, I think it's better though. Your geometry is right opposite way. Then S0 has dimension 0, it consists of points, and if you look for, say, SL minus 1, that will be L-dimensional manifold. Not very smooth, but yes. Yes, I'll come to that later, right, yes. Otherwise, your question, remember, luckily is not the case. So this is L-dimensional, not very smooth, relatively smooth manifold. By the way, we need also to find how smooth it is, because we want to apply Marty's method, dimensional manifold. remaining manifold. So we need to look at the structure of this MP, and by V I don't need me and Marty, because as I say, there is quite a lot of geometric works on that. That starts from Gromov, and I think the major person to whom we owe the understanding is Fukaya. So the part on the description of this of the structure of MP, and then what happens when you can add what is so-called Gromov-Hausdorff measured convergence. I come to that a bit later. It's actually Fukaya. What we need to do as analysts, put it this way, is to make the smoothness the best the possible. To some extent, was a little bit redundant. Okay, I also come to that. Okay, so what we need to do, therefore, we need to look at direct problem and inverse problem, say on this class M closure P. If you will be able to prove that heat kernel is nicely defined, therefore we can do this data, and if the inverse problem is unique, and if the direct problem is continuous, then the inverse problem is continuous, even on the closure, not only on MP, but on closure P, and we are done. Okay, so we have some stability result that I formulate slightly slightly late. But to speak about direct problem means to speak about, okay, let's now give you an example for fun. What can happen? Now, you know this example. So example is the following. It will be something with boundary. Well, you can twist it to make the boundary just, you know, to a point, because it's a ball, but don't bother. Let's say it is a boundary. Start with the following example. Take a three-dimensional cylinder my students like this way, X, Y, Z, right? This is a point zero, and the height of this cylinder is epsilon, and it has just usual Euclidean metric. And then I glue lower and upper, and say radius is 1, or actually 1 is not, radius is, okay, R. I glue upper and lower boundaries to make like a torus, you know, like a donut. But I do it sort of a little bit specially. I do it with a twist. So that means that I glue the point, this point, not with the point that is on top, but the point that is here. So for example, I twist by 180 degrees. It's really just math. It may be anything, you know, the group of rotation, 2 pi divided by n. So therefore, what happens is that if recall that this is a Euclidean metric, so a straight line is geodesic. So I go on top. That means that I come to this point. Then I continue. I go to bottom, and this is this point, right? So therefore, the closed geodesic will be to epsilon. So epsilon here, I come on this point. And then epsilon here, so closed geodesic has length to epsilon. Almost everywhere, with the exception of 0 point. If you rotate 0 point, you won't go far. So there is one exceptional geodesic along that axis that have length epsilon. And because there is this unexpected sharp change in the distance, there should appear some singularity. And indeed, what happens? You do this twist, and then you make epsilon go into zero. What happens? You have a cone. So when epsilon goes to zero, that becomes just a cone. This is R, if this R, and this is, because it's over 2, it's with pi, with angle pi. Okay, so there appears singularity. And that is the most innocent singularity you can imagine. So first of all, you see that there is a loss of dimension, there may be loss of dimension, and everything is fine here. I mean, okay, there is a boundary, but you know, it's a Euclidean metric. Its curvature is zero, so everything is fine. There may be loss of dimensionality, and there appear singularities. That's from where comes this stratification. Okay. So in this case, by the way, you see that there is only one single point that corresponds to a zero. It's is this vertex. You take out the vertex, you come to smooth manifold. Okay. Now, now comes the issue of the direct map. So you want to look for the heat kernel. Oh well, I mean, it turns out that on this, first of all, now let's look more carefully on this stratification. It turns out that this SK, the manifold part, is big. So it turns out that that actually your M becomes this limit M. It's a metric space, so it is, becomes belongs to MP, and that P, of course, P here P. It's a length space. That means that any two points can be connected by a shortest, and it's connected, and this SK is large. It's actually geodesically convex. So if you have two points, so the, like in here, you know, if you want to go the shortest trip from any point not on the vertex to any other point, you wouldn't go to the vertex. So your shortest geodesic will avoid the singular point. So with SK being geodesically convex. And here I pronounce some forbidden word geodesically. What do I mean by geodesic? I mean there are millions of definitions of shortest, is straightest. So what do I mean here? Here by geodesic I mean shortest. So the geodesic between the two points is actually the shortest path between these two points. Then it turns out that on this S there is a metric and this geodesic is actually geodesic with respect to this metric. So this is Riemannian metric on SK. And then if you go along this, the shortest will be just usual geodesic. So therefore this is just this is shortest geodesic in Riemannian sense. So it turns out that this structure somehow is not that particular bad, except for something that is of co-dimension at least one and measure zero. Other things are just an open Riemannian manifold. Well, we need to be a little bit careful because G is not C infinity anymore. So G slightly loses its smoothness. It was known, it was proven actually by Foucault that G is C1 alpha for any alpha less than 1, and we improve it that G is actually belongs to C2 star. And that's somehow the best possible result. C2 star is the second Zygmund class. So let me explain what is the first Zygmund class, and then the second. So what is C1 star? The function f of x belongs to C1 star, this is first Zygmund class, means the following. If you compare the value of the function, but not in two adjacent points, but what you do is that you look for the second derivative. So you take f of x minus 2 f of x plus y divided by 2 and plus f of y. So that's what appears in the second derivative. But now you divide it by x minus y. And this guy is bounded, and the best possible bound is, so this is bounded, and the best here is actually the norm of F, well, almost like norm, you need to also take the maximum, sort of, okay, CF, and then the best possible CF explaining the norm. Now, it is, this class of function is slightly worse than just Lipschitz. So we have that Lipschitz belongs to here. Obviously, if you have just one, then add them together, you get from Lipschitz this one. It is slightly worse than Lipschitz, but it has some very, very nice... C to star means... so F belongs to C to star. It's equivalent to the fact that F belongs to C1 star and gradient F belongs to C1 star.
So
F belongs, actually F belongs to C1 alpha for any alpha less than, that implies that, now of course you will say, what do you mean X plus Y, you know, we are sitting on the manifold, it's in any chart you can do that and you go from one chart to the other, you just, and strictly speaking of course you need to be careful finding the charts, because if you do worse charts, you can lose smoothness. So what charts that are proper here will be harmonic coordinates. So this is in harmonic coordinates. So your metric tensor G is C to star in harmonic coordinates. This is sort of the thing that makes function the smoother possible. Okay. What is the advantage of this C2 star for analysts? There is no advantage for C2 star, almost no, for geometer. But for analysts, there is advantage. The point is that if you look for what Marty mentioned, non-branching of geodesics, geodesics is a solution of something like, we have a vector field. If you write down equation for the bi-characteristics, then it involves the derivative of respect to X of the metric. So, therefore, to look for the behavior of bi-characteristics, you are looking, well, I put it X dot, Xi dot is D, one more H. That's Hamiltonian, right? So I put ham. Over d xi, and this is minus d Hamiltonian over dx, right? And if you're, since g is from c to star, this right-hand side, this vector field, called altogether vector field f, it belongs to c1 star. Right? You lose one derivative. And it turns out, everybody knows, of course, the Poisson theorem, that if the vector field goes to C0, 1, the solution is unique. It turns out that you can prove it using Osgood theorem for C1 star. And it is not true for C alpha. For any alpha, actually for intersection of C alphas, there may be branching geodesics. Remember Marty showed that how we proved the injectivity. If you go just along normal for some fixed time, and it comes to the same point. But if there is branching, this proof fails. It does mean that everything fails, but we don't know how to do it. So our proof fails. Maybe still it works, but we don't know. Okay? So, of course, geometers say that who cares? You have sectional curvature bounding. Sectional curvature bounding from below means there is no branching of geodesics. Okay, it's another approach to that. If you have Alexandrov space, and this Alexandrov space, the sectional curvature bounded from below, then geodesic don't branch. Okay, so since you have almost Riemannian manifold, some nasty points, but they have measure zero, and they're lying somewhere, you know, in narrow set near the boundary or something like that, so they don't divide your manifold, you can describe Laplace operator. You can describe Laplace operator starting from Dirichlet form. Dirichlet form involves only metric and first derivative. Actually, not even derivative, it involves only the distance. But here you can even do derivative. So you can do Laplace operator on M belonging to this closure. One can define Laplacian. Basically, looking on SK, because it's the major theme. So, from Dirichlet form. This integral, I can say about SK minus 1 on the smooth part, and then I take the norm of the gradient U with this respect to metric, I denote it by G. The rest of the metric G, D mu G. Again, I prefer to use a probabilistic measure. Okay. So, and then by the classical theory of quadratic forms, you apply Laplacian, and then it turns out that the resolvent is complex operator, and you do all these things about the eigenvalues, eigenfunctions, eigenfunctions from a basis in L2, and so on and so forth. And by the way, from here, you see that eigenfunction definitely belongs to H1, right? Because it starts with quadratic form. Which is not enough for inverse problems, for the version of inverse problems that I will be using that actually is based upon the analysis of the eigenfunctions. But before going to that, let us go back to the direct problem. So, I started with the Riemannian manifolds, and when I close this class of Riemannian manifold, I get these metric spaces that are almost Riemannian manifolds. I defined on them Laplace operator, and then my guess is that when Riemannian manifolds converge to this limit in the Gromov-Hausdorff sense, then spectrally, and Heitkernel, remember, describes the spectrum. Spectrally, the Laplace operator for the manifolds converge to the Laplace operator for this one. And that's not the case. And that is, I think, was probably the main idea in this series of papers of Foucaire. He understood the following story, that you can analyze the spectral convergence, but only Gromov metric is not enough. You need also to look what happens with the measure. So, and he introduced the notion of measured Gromov-Hausdorff convergence. So let us return to this, my definition. Luckily, I haven't yet destroyed it. And let me modify it. Ah, right, yes. You should be pretty strong to do that. X and Y, metric measure spaces. Metric measure spaces. Okay, so they introduce the measure on both X and Y, and they will say that that D measure Gromov-Hausdorff between X and Y is less than epsilon if epsilon is not necessarily small, it's really quasi distance. So it doesn't mean that it's really small, it's a distance. So if there is a now not just a map, but a measurable map. First of all, that distorts very little the distance. And second, it distorts very little measure. And to say how it distorts very little measure, it is sort of generalization of Prokhorov distance on measures. So what does it tell us? So this is about distance. It's one. And now I go back to this wooden stick. And two is the following. Take any, I use A and A prime. These are measurable in X and Y. I put it B. X and Y. So let's take the measure in X of F minus 1 of B. So B is in Y. B is in Y, A is in X. F minus 1, right? F minus 1 of B. I take the measure of this guy and compare it not with the measure of B. I need to be go large. So I take measure in Y of the epsilon vicinity of B and I add epsilon. And I do the same, of course, opposite way around. So I take that mu y of f prime minus y of a is less or equal mu x of a epsilon plus epsilon. And a epsilon is the epsilon vicinity, the Hermitian space, so it's an epsilon vicinity of a. Okay? So if this is satisfied, we say that the distance measured Gronhaus, the distance between these metric measure spaces is less than epsilon. It's strictly speaking not a distance. It's a quasi-distance. Meaning that, you know, it's not, you don't have triangular equality, you have almost triangular equality, something like that. D mu x z is less than, I think it's 3 here. D mu gh of x and y plus d mu gh of y and z. But still, it's a nice object. Okay. Why do I go, yes?
So the nitro mu is induced by the nitric in X or just a new measure in X?
At the moment, it's completely, this is completely abstract definition. You have two metric measure spaces. And what does it mean that I metric measured Gronhaus dot closed? That's it. Now I return back to what we do with our MPs, right? And come to see what is there. And remember what we want to do, we want that the heat kernel converges. And heat kernel is spectral theme. So somehow you can believe me that I can prove that eigenvalues converge and eigenfunctions in some sense converge because of the formula that heat kernel is expressed in terms of eigenvalues and eigenfunctions that also converge. And to see what happens, let us go to the example. And let me, not to make mistake, try to find in here where is this example. Yes. Now let's go to the example. Now I start with a torus, but with special measures, simple as to torus. So I have S1, no, that is not S1, it's just a circle, cross S1, and I put here that this is a Y variable and this is Z variable. Okay? And then I denote the metric in the following way, ds squared plus, oh sorry, equals to dy squared plus sigma squared C squared of y dz squared. And C of y is a nice positive sum function. So if I try to draw what is happens, I try to do it. And sigma with parameters. So this is here y runs. And then you have a torus that somehow changes. its radius. When you go around, because of CY. So the radius is radius is just sigma CY. Okay? Well, now you do the following trick. You go sigma to zero. And what happens metrically? Metrically, it obviously goes to the circle, correct? So it goes to the circle in the sense of Gromov-Hausdorff, so this guy will belong to our limit. But let's look for the spectral thing. Let's look for the spectral of this guy. And obviously, examples should be such that we can easily do it. So easily doesn't mean that I shouldn't look at here. So I'm looking for the Laplace, and I call this M, and it depends upon sigma, right? Because this parameter sigma that will go to zero. And then if I look, the situation will be the following. So I'm looking for the eigenfunctions. Laplace sigma is Laplace corresponding to this one, plus lambda sigma j, phi j sigma of y and z equals to zero. So I'm looking for the eigenfunction and eigenvalues of this operator. And what do I see? Well, obviously in the z direction, we should have just rotation. So phi j sigma of y and z will first of all e to the power I m z, and then by some functions, put it k sigma, that also depends upon m, and some, is it J? I think it's J of Y. Okay, and if you honestly plug it into the equation, then we get the following equation for this phi. I hope it's honest. And let's put here minus, sorry, in the paper, Laplace is minus Laplacian. Then it becomes minus 1 over C of Y, D over DY, C of Y, D, well, it should be, of course, normal derivative of this F, divided by DY, plus M squared over C squared of Y, sigma squared F equals to lambda. And now let me put it, let's probably put here L, because G will be function of, it's function of M and L, of sigma F sigma. Okay? So, so what we see, that this is not just, it's not just the usual, it's not just a usual Laplacian. It's Laplacian with respect to some weight. And what happens, so we, it's not just usual Laplacian. Laplacian with some weight, is it C squared or minus C squared, something like that. So that is not, if you look where, at which space the separator is self-adjoint, it's not just a circle. It's a circle with weight either C squared or minus C squared. Okay? So somehow we obtained a natural Laplacian, but it's not usual Laplacian. Laplacian in the weighted space. So somehow it corresponds not to the lengths dy, but to the lengths c plus minus one y dy. Okay. Now that's the first thing that we understand, that if you go to the limit, in addition to the metric, there appears volume element that is not just Riemannian volume. It's Riemannian volume dy multiplied by something. And then we see one more interesting story. Okay, so let us look for different m. The first case, m is zero. Then it's just, you look for this operator, right? It's then phi 0, phi 0 L of sigma is just of y is actually independent of sigma. Of sigma and is an eigenvalue, eigenfunction of this weighted Laplacian of this guy, of this weighted Laplacian of minus 1 over c d dy c d dy. Okay? If, however, m is not equal to 0, then we don't bother. Why we don't bother? Because when sigma goes to 0, this guy goes to infinity. Then this m squared of cy sigma squared is more than some constant. Well, it's 1 divided by maximum of this guy. So it is some c sigma minus 2. And the eigenvalues that correspond to these m's, just if it's, well, I mean, if you finite energy, we just don't see them anymore. Therefore, what we see that spectrally, if you're looking for any interval of energies, and look for the heat kernel, very large energies play no role at positive t, because e to the 1 minus lambda kt is really going to the eigenfunctions, to the spectral behavior of this Laplace operator with non-trivial density function. Okay, so morale is probably would make break. I probably start to finish earlier. Okay, morale is that if you want to track what's going with heat kernel, just treating only the Gromov-Hausdorff convergence is not enough. We need also to track what goes on with the volume. Well, we started with manifolds M, and the volume there is just the Riemannian volume or measure is this probabilistic measure. But when we go to the limit and we want to see what happens with the spectral data with heat kernel, then we need to also be care that we have not just metric convergence, but we have metric measure convergence. And the result of Foucaire is the following. He actually, well, the fact that this class MP is precomplete with respect to Gromov-Hausdorff convergence is actually the basic ground, for example, of his book of 81. And the result that Foucaire obtained in late 80s, I think it's 89, he proved that it's simultaneously precomplete with respect to metric measure convergence. And And when speaking of metric measure convergence, you should distinguish this picture just from the say, usual donut that has very little Dow in it, right? In the less
and
less.
And is Foucaire able to get a stratification in which the measure is also smooth on the main stratum?
I'll come to that later. Very good. Just very good. 5 minutes. Yes. And again, there is an industry on that. So therefore, we close, and to indicate that we take care both of metric and measure, instead of one M, we use two M's. So now if you look at, instead of MP, I like MMP, metric measure, right? P means they're pointed, because to solve inverse problem, we need to have the center. Well, of lambda N, lambda DN, is the same object, is the same manifolds of curvature less than lambda, sectional curvature, and dimension and diameter less than d, equipped with the normal Riemannian volume. But now we look for their closure with respect to metric measure topology, with respect to this, well, 1 and 2. Yes? And because it's more than that, let's call it its closure. And if you look only on the metric properties, It's the same as we get up earlier. But there appear new measure elements. So therefore, so if I have now M in here, it has still point, so M is in here, it has H, and I call G, sorry. And I don't bother that G is well defined only on this k-dimensional Riemannian part, and we don't know what is on this thin bad portion. And it has the density function rho. So the probabilistic measure in here, d mu of this m, is actually rho, and then this is Riemannian probabilistic measure. So in particular, of course, integral of rho d mu h equals to 1. dg, right. Yes, thank you very much. Yes. Unfortunately, the proof, you need some groups, and the groups use g, and so it's a... okay? So, and if you write down what will be the corresponding Laplacian, it will be weighted Laplacian. The Laplacian will be one over, in coordinates, it will be one over a rho square root of g di square root of g gij rho dj. Okay? So like it was there. Now, yes, it's very natural and useful for us. So for example, for Tartaro's result that Marty used, and it turns out can be translated into here. It's very important to find what is rho. Now, and actually it's very important to find the best possible rho. Now, it turns out, well, what is the history? Foucault himself proved that rho is continuous. And then Kasue proved that rho is C1 alpha. So, before us, metric and rho was C1 alpha, and guess what we did? C2 star. And that is very natural again, because how we proved it is the following. The fact that, it is the time. Okay? So then it turns out, so that is now our class of the object that we. Then in this class, H is heat kernel is well defined, and we can consider the heat kernel convergence, which honestly we can prove. Maybe I'll tell about more precisely of this later. So we can prove that if you have the, actually even not like, if you have the manifolds, right, converging to this limit case in the measured Gromov-Hausdorff, then somehow the heat kernels converge on the whole objects, in particular in our ball. You can actually put here these guys not from the closure, not necessarily from the manifolds. So to have compactness results, you want to have this all to work in the whole compact. So then we get that this implies heat convergence. The only thing now is the simplest thing, basically what Marty told you, is to prove for that on the closure in those problems is uniquely solvable. So that means that you can find the metric and rho. Now, Marty today, he yesterday told how to find the metric, and today he told how to find rho. But basically the idea is almost the same. Well, so if you already know metric, say eigenfunctions satisfy this equation, and the version of the, that I definitely tell, the version of the boundary control method that we actually represent a point as values of all eigenfunctions in this point. We take the spectral representation of the manifold. It's again mapping manifold in something infinite dimensional, R infinity in this case. And it's again sort of like Gromov idea. And then you can prove that this gives you the whole information like this boundary distance map. So, and then if you know, then you basically recover your manifold as a set in R infinity. And from here you can find the coordinates on the smooth part. And then this GIJ and rho. Okay? So, more or less, the summary is that sort of modifying what Marty said in two directions. First of all, take into account that we deal with non-really smooth cases. We should take care about this singular part. And second, that in this case we prefer, though it is not completely necessary, we can still speak about sort of analog of boundary distance map, but working with a spectral representation of the manifold, having heat data, mainly, so I probably have it here. Yes. So, there's one slight change, and this slight change is the following. Now it's also raw, right? So we are looking, and this belongs to the closure. Measured Gromov-Hausdorff closure of our class. So if we sit it inside the ball is not necessarily open set, but and we know the heat kernel, and we know the value of the heat kernel in the dense set of points and dense set of times, we can recover this object. What do I mean by recover the object? We recover an isometric copy. So first of all, we recover the metric space. So this guy is a metric space. And then we recover this smooth part, means that we recover this SK minus SK minus 1 as a Riemannian manifold plus rho. Okay. And more or less, the stability result is hand-waving, it's just the use of compactness type arguments. Let me formulate the theorem and then make a corollary. And I think it's proper time. So, assume we have two these stratified manifolds with this density, so it's M1 and P1, they're pointed, and then H1, row 1, I put it I, and I is 1, 2. And assume that, metric is G, sorry. Thank you, Matthew. And assume that we have the following data. Now, we have two sets, so we have R, so this first thing, we have second R more than zero. That is the ball when we make measurement. And we have sets of points, X, I, P, and I here 1, 2, and P from 1 to some number that it depends upon delta, and delta will be small parameter. And what is this? These are delta nets in DRPI. Okay. And the number of points, by the way, here I is the same. So if you have less delta, maybe you can just count some points twice. And you also have delta net, I put it TL, L from 1, and here it's easy to find how many of them should be, but I put it J of delta. This is epsilon net on delta minus 1. That is where we measure time. Epsilon would be the other parameter that tells you how they're close, basically. Sorry, you're right. It's the same. Sorry. Thank you. Well, at the moment, it's just a number. Assume that we have delta net in the ball's balls, we have delta net in time, and we measure heat kernels for the first model and the second model using Mach's physical language. So, and they measure heat kernel H of XP, XQ, XP1, XQ1, SQ1, TL. That is one means that we are living in the first manifold. And compare, and H was beautiful H, and compare with heat kernel on these points on the second certified manifold. Phew, sorry. Delta. Okay? Yes. Yes, right. So then there is a modulus of continuity function it depends upon R and also of course lambda d and n of delta, its modulus of continuity. Meaning that it goes, it's positive, it goes to zero when delta goes to zero. Such that, so if you have two certified manifolds from our class, then you can tell me the answer. Right, that's a metric measure distance. And the second guy, I put just M2, is less than omega of delta. Okay? So that means they have many, many, well, anyway, that means what is written there. Now let me tell you some funny corollary of this result. Because this looks very, 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 very sort of non-analytic. Well, I mean, how, what do you mean, they're close? And the corollary is the following. And somehow it goes to what Günther was telling. He said that, well, there is some dense set of manifolds, and then in some vicinity of these manifolds, if something close, then the manifolds are close. And this vicinity depends upon which manifold we choose. And this is the same answer. This is the same answer. It tells you the following, that if you pick a manifold, pick some manifold, Riemannian manifold M, G, now because manifold just in M and P itself, right? Not the closure. Then, for this manifold, there is delta zero, and depends upon the manifold, all other is the same, R is the same, you know, such that if condition of the theorem are satisfied, then, so that means that there is M prime, i.e., M prime is epsilon less than epsilon zero close to it's not M close, it's a date is close. That i.e. the heat data of M prime is epsilon less than epsilon less delta less than delta zero of M close to heat data of M in the sense of what is written here, you know, in this the sense of this definition, then this M prime is actually a manifold. There are no singularities anymore. Moreover, M prime is diffeomorphic to M. And here, by the way, automatically rho equals to 1, because we're on the manifolds. The isomorphic to M. And second, assume the isomorphism is just identity. And second, if you compare the metric tensors, then, well, I should put here also alpha, because alpha is how we compare. I put is less some, no, here's no alpha, some other modulus of continuity, omega alpha of delta. So when you're speaking not about global stability, but about sort of local stability, you can get more. You can get really that what you're looking around is a manifold, and it is so very sort of natural and analytically close. And to see how it seems, it's pretty simple. The point is the following, that if you look at example one, then what stands here near M is something that is metrically close to original manifold M. Original manifold M has an injectivity rate, some positive injectivity radius. And when you metrically change it, your injectivity radius can decrease only a little bit. So therefore, what stands in the nearby will be something that have injectivity radius bounded from below. But then there is another result of Anderson, Katsuda, Michael Taylor, Marty, and me, that in this case, you have that. And that's probably it. I think I should stop now. Thank you very much. If you
take the row, the wave function in front of the matrix.
Yes.
The measure, and if you take the wave function as 1 over the volume of M, so
it's a constant.
Yeah, it's constant because
you forget about it because it's just a probabilistic measure in the original manifold, right?
Yeah, but I want to see why you add one more condition.
That is that example. The fact that you have just manifolds that metrically collapse to something doesn't imply that their spectrum converges. But if they collapse with the volume, with this metric measure, then spectral converges. So that's what is there. Change this C, and of course spectrum will change. So there's no spectral convergence. So you need to see what is going with the measure. Oh, no, volume, look, that's a good question, actually, what you said. I don't speak about volume. Foucaille didn't speak about the volume. Volume, of course, collapses, but probability measure doesn't. It's always one. And you should take care. I mean, what is spectral conversion? It's eigenfunction conversion and eigenvalues conversion. Take the first zero eigenvalues, one. What is eigenfunction? It's one divided by volume. When volume goes to infinity, does converge to anywhere. But if you look for respect to probability measure, it's just one. It's always one. You see? So it's not volume. It's where you need to use probability measure. Okay? Sorry?
You take the
volume over VH, right. And that is now invariant. That is doesn't behave bad when you collapse.
Yes.
And somehow I think it's somehow very, very sort of standard now, this metric measure spaces. So people, do their work, and they are related actually to the spectral things, not only distance but also measure. You're looking for Dirichlet form after all. That's what is your object. Okay. So Dirichlet form will converge. One Dirichlet form to on M. If M goes to M, then Dirichlet form for MN converges to Dirichlet form on M.
this room, you have a lower bound for the volume of the space, right? It's the volume of this room.
Yes.
What happens to this whole business if you impose also a lower bound on the volume?
Just only the lower bound. So you mean that the volume of this room is small?
So we have, let's say, a three-dimensional manifold. We have no idea what it is, but we know that it contains this room.
Right. So and how to find probabilistic measure? Go look for the heat kernel when t goes to infinity.
Yeah.
When t goes to infinity, with respect to the normal, what you really do, you don't know the probabilistic measure of the whole universe because you don't know universe.
Right.
Hopefully, it's, well, people believe that it's compact. So therefore, you look for the heat kernel with respect to the usual Riemannian metric. So what will be that? Yes? Sorry. No.
So, for example, right now we think the world is three-dimensional, but the string figures tell us maybe it is whatever dimension they think it is at
yes.
the moment and all the other dimensions are small.
Yes.
But let's say we think the universe is three-dimensional.
Yes.
We look at this room and we see that it has at least 1 cubic meter of volume.
Yes.
So now what do we know about our manifold? Its volume, let's say its sectional curvatures are bounded above and its volume is bounded.
Then injectivity radius is bounded from below, yes.
Well, maybe we don't even know the injectivity radius.
It is bounded from below, right.
Okay, but we know the volume of this room.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I'm thinking that these degeneracies cannot fully occur because
we know the volume of the room. You're absolutely right. Now, if you know that you have this class with sectional curvature bounded, actually it's enough even in Ricci curvature, and diameter bounded, and if you know that volume is more than something, obviously more than volume of this room, then injectivity radius is bounded from below. And then, yes. And then you get that when you close this space, this class of Riemannian manifolds that have injectivity bounds from below, you get again Riemannian manifolds. So rho is 1, and the whole, and it's Riemannian with g from c to star. Now, in our problem, we somehow don't know the dimensionality and therefore the volume. We just have a point, you know. Just somebody, you close your eyes, you don't see the whole picture, you just know some points, and these points you make measurements. There is no volume in our measurements, right?
Okay, so not this.
Actually, there is no dimensionality of the volume, right? Question?
I just want to make sure the weight volume doesn't collapse that much because look at that example. In the
weighted volume?
Yeah, the volume.
On the limit in space?
Yeah.
On the limit in space, there are two, you remember. So first of all, limit in space is a space. It does collapse anymore. It's all the limit. So therefore, it has Riemannian structure. And it's Riemannian volume because non-Riemannian part has measure 0 is just this guy, correct? It's d integral over d v g over this limit case. Okay, I put it s k minus 1, right? So then it gives rise to the probabilistic measure on this limit in space. That is, d mu g is just dvg divided by the whole vg. Okay? And then there is a density function that is normalized. So there's also density function such that rho d mu g is 1. Okay? And by the way, one more thing. You can prove that on this whole class, this density function is bounded from below and above. So there's a C depending on lambda, N, and D, so rho is more than 1 over C and less than C.
I have a comment if it's closer. So if some follow up to the phenomena, if it even requires that the dimension of the manifold is shrinking, is it necessary that we think that there is only some dimensions that have like very small diameter? And now this this volume collapse in other way, that it must mathematically collapse everywhere. So it might collapse in different speed, but the order of the diameter has to be comparable everywhere. So if you try to answer the question that if the diameter of this collapse at the Planck constant, it derives in space and time, how it derives, then one sees it in this wave function rho.
Yeah. So this is not the case, for example, if you have, well, something like a torus. Let me try to draw a torus, right? This is a torus. And then you do just like that. So it becomes